You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Whoa. Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports. Only on the Ignotainment Media Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Broadcasting from St. Louis, Missouri, on site for Bellator Unfinished Business, Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll discuss Fabricio Werdum's submission win over Cain Velasquez at last Saturday's UFC 188 in Mexico City to claim the UFC's undisputed heavyweight championship. Big John and I will also examine the co-main event from that card, Eddie Alvarez's split decision win over Gilbert Melendez, which has created a great deal of debate and controversy. And we'll be speaking exclusively to Bellator MMA president Scott Coker in advance of one of the biggest cards in the promotion's history. Plus, as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. So ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Well, of course, last Saturday night in Mexico City, then UFC interim heavyweight champion Fabricio Werdum recorded a third-round submission win over reigning UFC heavyweight champion Cain Velasquez to claim the promotion's undisputed heavyweight title. John, this was quite simply an outstanding performance from Werdum, and I think one that really shocked a lot of knowledgeable MMA fans and media types.
What do you mean knowledgeable? Obviously, they're not that knowledgeable. Now, you know what? My whole view of that fight was, the fight itself was phenomenal. And it was phenomenal because both guys came out to do what they do. And a lot of people were, you know, a lot of people were discounting Fabricio, and I kept telling people, you can't do that. And I go, this is not the same fighter as in the past. You know, Fabricio has turned into a guy that is not just diving to get to the ground. Obviously, his ground game is probably it is the best in the heavyweight division. If you look at jiu-jitsu wise, he's got the best ground game there. It's just that's the way it is. But he used to be diving for takedowns, and he was worried about the stand-up, and you could see how he was trying to avoid things. He's a different guy now. Rafael Cordero has done an incredible job of getting him to be a good stand-up fighter. He's moving his head. He's got good angles he's taking. He's throwing straight shots because he's long. And if you look at what happened in that fight with him and Cain, you know, Cain came out with a lot of aggression. I thought Fabricio looked very much in the first 3 minutes or so like he did against Travis Brown. Travis Brown came out with a lot of aggression towards him, and he almost looked uncomfortable a little bit, but he was surviving, and he was just doing just enough to make it to where he had some offense. He obviously wasn't winning the round, but about 2 minutes into it, he started actually starting to throw some combinations and actually starting putting pressure back on Cain. Cain won the first round, but when it came out into the second round, Fabricio was the fighter that was throwing the effective offensive, you know, shots. Cain was going after him. Cain was landing some stuff at times. Cain actually hurt him, but he was hurting Cain back, and he was snapping Cain's head back with that jab. The kicks were effective. His knees, when he gets inside, he's grabbing for that, you know, that Muay Thai clinch, and he's doing a beautiful job of bringing that knee straight up. It doesn't come out. It comes straight up. And that's the mark of a guy that's been trained the proper way of doing something. So Fabricio Werdum was, a lot of people giving Cain so much credit was because of how Cain is, how he fights, that pace that he brings. And I can understand that. But, you know, he was fighting a real guy in Fabricio Werdum. And this is not a shock. This is what the heavyweight division is in the UFC. And you're looking at these guys, and every guy in that, you know, top part, you're looking at, you know, Fabricio being the top guy, you got Cain, you got Junior, you know, there's even, you know, if you can bring Alistair into that now, even Travis Brown, Andrei Arlovsky, all of these guys on the right given day, they all have the skills that can put the other guys away.
Fabricio Werdum turns 38 years old next month. He made his pro MMA debut June 2002. John, he's a classic example of a fighter that comes into the sport being great at one thing, but continues to evolve to become a complete mixed martial artist.
Exactly, and that's, you know, that's what we're seeing now out of Fabricio compared to what he was in the past. You look at Fabricio when he fought, you know, obviously when he was in the UFC before, he got knocked out by Junior Dos Santos with a big shot. That was at a time when he wasn't real comfortable in the stand-up, and it showed. And it showed that's why he gets caught with the shot that he got caught with. And that uppercut, he's ducking his head down against Junior, and he gets caught. And then he ends up going into Strikeforce and starts to put together some really nice wins in Strikeforce, ends up being the first guy to beat Fedor, does it with submissions, you know, and it wasn't that he stood up with him. He actually, you know, fainted like he was almost hurt because he got hit in the chest, really. You know, I did that fight. He didn't get hit with a shot.
I just rewatched that fight. It was on my cables in demand, and they uploaded it. And I just watched. I hadn't watched it since it was live. And he does. He almost flops. He kind of gets clipped.
Almost the same as what he did with Kane, you know, in the first round of the fight he just had. But he was bringing someone into his world. And I thought Kane was very smart when he went and, you know, stood up from him. That was a smart fighter. But you look at everything that Fabricio's done up to that point. His one fight that he had with Alistair Overeem, that was in the Strikeforce. That was the one that he showed that he still didn't have the confidence in his stand-up. He was worried about standing with Alistair and kept flopping to the ground, trying to bring Alistair, saying, you know, come down in my world. Well, that's not the way MMA works. We give the, you know, the standing fighter has control of the position. If the standing fighter wants to go down, he can go down. If he wants the other person to have to stand up, he backs up away from him. And as the official, we are forced to get that person up off the ground. And so at that point, Fabricio still didn't have that confidence. But I believe if Fabricio fought Alistair now, I'm not saying that Alistair doesn't have a chance of winning. I'm not saying Fabricio doesn't. I'm saying it's going to be a different fight because we have somebody in Fabricio Werdum that has a confidence about his stand-up now that was never there before.
You referenced the Fabricio Werdum, Alistair Overeem fight in Strikeforce. And thinking back to that fight, Werdum is continually not just on his back, but he's waving Overeem in, and Overeem's not going to play that game. You contrast that to what Werdum did against Travis Brown in the UFC. Completely different fighters, completely different approaches to striking.
That's it. He's evolved, you know, and look at, you know, as time goes on, when you look and you say, you know, Fabricio is, what is he, 37, 38 years old, but he's a young 37, 38. He hasn't been damaged a lot in the sport. He hasn't taken a lot. He hasn't had some of those wars that have gone on that have, you know, taken parts of him. And so he's not an old fighter. He's a young fighter still. He's still got, a, you know, quite a few years left that he can compete at a high level, especially with as effective as his ground game is. He forces fighters, you know, if there's one thing that I'll say in that fight, I don't blame Kane for doing what he did. I don't blame Kane when Kane took him down and then stood up away from him. I thought that was smart. It puts Fabricio in the position of knowing, hey, I'll take you down, but it also took away one of the big elements that makes Kane successful. What makes Kane who he is and so hard to deal with is that he will stand up with you. He'll throw big shots. He'll grind you into the fence and beat on you. He'll take you down and beat on you on the ground. And you never know where he's going and what he's going to do. And that makes him so dangerous as far as having to deal with all of these elements. But as soon as he stood up away from Fabricio, he's telling you, I don't want to be on the ground with that guy right now. And that little bit is taking a big chunk of what Kane is and what makes him successful. It's taking it away from him, and it's telling Fabricio, you don't want to go down here with me, so I can open up. It doesn't matter if you take me down because you're going to get up. I don't mind being on the ground. Go ahead and take me down. So it opens up Fabricio striking in a different way that makes him really effective because he can come in with those straight shots and be effective because if he takes him down, who cares?
Every week on Let's Get It On, we bring you our poll question. You can, of course, cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. This week's poll question, is Fabricio Werdum the greatest submission fighter in MMA heavyweight history? Let us know what you think. Vote yes or no at letsgetitonpodcast.com.
That's a good one. Is he? Wow.
Well, you think about his career, right? 20 pro MMA victories, 10 of those wins by submission. Look at who he submitted. Cain Velasquez, Fedor Emelianenko, Alexander Emelianenko, a very underrated heavyweight, Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, Tom Erickson, another old-school underrated heavyweight. Those are tough guys to submit. Velasquez has been submitted once, and that's by Werdum. Emelianenko, Fedor Emelianenko has been submitted once. That's by Werdum.
Yeah, that's true. You look at some of these. I don't think Who submitted Alex besides Verdum? He's been knocked out, got kicked in the head by Krokop, but submitted, I don't think anyone.
I think he's been submitted two or three
really,
times.
Has he? Okay.
But I know Fedor Emelianenko, of his losses, the only one by submission. And obviously Velasquez, that was just his second loss, and this is the only one by submission. Dos Santos knocked him out in their first fight.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Well, as to do most people.
I was the bad guy. They don't, the only referee that gave Kane a loss. Yeah, no.
John, you think about Verdum, and I don't know if you've had a chance to roll with him. You're a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, but you came up through the Gracie Academy in Torrance, California. You rolled with Horion, you rolled with Hickson, you rolled with Hoist. Where do you think in different fighters, and we're talking now about Gi Jiu-Jitsu, but with the submission, let's talk about Hickson Gracie. Where do you think the submission game compares with that in Verdum?
Oh, my God. You know, the one thing about Hickson that was – Hickson was – the easiest way for me to say he was a genius when it came to Jiu-Jitsu. You know, and when I say genius, it was because everything he did was very basic. Everything he does is still very basic. It's not that he's this, you know, guy that does these spectacular moves or does these brand new kinds of elements like an Eddie Bravo that brings in all these different types of, you know, ways of doing something, or, you know, Marcelo Garcia, the way he handles things. Hickson was all about the actual geometry of the human body and how it put pressure in certain ways onto another human body. And the way he did that, it was like he was a mathematical genius in understanding how to put pressure on a body. Fabricio he's close in the way he does things. He just does things with more power. He's a bigger, stronger guy. And he's very technical in the way he goes about doing something. But when Fabricio grabs a hold of something, like when he grabbed a hold of that guillotine, you know, as we were sitting there looking, I go, fight's done. And you could see it because you saw how deep it was. And there's no way that Kane's going to get his head out from that hold as deep as it was. And you could even see in Fabricio when he grabbed a hold of it, he starts to smile. You know, he actually started almost laughing because it's like, I got you. And you know you're not getting your head away from me with as deep as it is. And there are just certain guys that have a technical skill. Frank Mir is a really good submission fighter, but he doesn't have the same type of technique that Fabricio does. Everybody's different. Josh Barnett is an incredible submission fighter, but he does things in a different way than Frank Mir and a different way than Fabricio. Everyone does things their own way.
And if you look at Barnett, he's coming really from a catch wrestling, Frank Gotch sort of school of thought.
Yeah, well, Josh will always say, I'm a catch wrestler. He does, you know, he is a catch wrestler, but he does all the elements of jiu-jitsu with his catch wrestling. It all intermixes. It all intermingles. And Josh does things from a power standpoint. When he grabs a hold of something, it's got technique, but it's also got that Frank Gotch, you know, power behind it, that when they're going to rip it off. Now, jiu-jitsu guys are always coming from the school of, oh, you know what, nice and smooth and easy and, you know, relax. It's a little bit different, but look, at any fighter, when they're going and they go after that submission, trust me, they're putting power on it.
John, the last point on Fabricio Verdum, he'll turn 38 again next month. What do you think is his future? What can be his legacy? Because if you look at the long history of UFC heavyweight champions, you don't have those long reigns. You don't have those George St. Pierre type reigns, just because most heavyweights will tell you basically anybody over 200 pounds can knock another man out.
Yes, they can. You know, the one thing I look at, it, the victory by Fabricio opens up the division in a way that Kane was sitting on top of the division. He had already fought Junior three times. Yes, he had the one loss, and then he came back and he beat him twice. And you looked, and he had gone through a lot of the guys that were there. He had never fought Alistair, so that was a fight that you could make. He had never fought Travis, but Travis has gone and lost his last fight against Andre. He hadn't fought Andre, so yeah, you can bring him in. But the one thing that I really like with, you know, what they can do now is Fabricio does have some losses against some of these guys. And there is some interesting matchups. You bring him in against Andre Arlovsky. He lost to Andre, you know, when Andre was actually, you know, going to be leaving the UFC. And he, you know, didn't have the stand-up that he has now. He's a different fighter. You know, he's lost to, you know, Overeem. It's going to be interesting putting him back in there. There's guys that he can match up with. It will be interesting. He's lost to Junior Dos Santos. there's a lot of guys that are sitting beneath him that he wants to come back and you know what, let's correct what happened in the past, and I want a chance at those guys. So there's a lot of fights out there for Fabricio for the next 2-3 years if he continues to win, that are all good matchups for the UFC. They're all good matchups in watching people because they have a story behind it that this guy already beat our champion. Can he beat him again? And, you know, that's what fighting's all about. And then you got Kane. You know, you could bring Kane back. You know, just because he lost the one doesn't mean that he's going to lose in the rematch. He's already proven that he can come back when he did that with Junior.
Well, there was definitely no controversy in the Fabricio Werdum win over Cain Velasquez in the main event of UFC 188. But that was definitely not the case with the co-main event last Saturday night in Mexico City. John, you, of course, refereed the fight. Former Bellator lightweight world champion Eddie Alvarez defeated former Strikeforce lightweight champion Gilbert Melendez by split decision, result that is still being debated and discussed. And, John, it again puts the spotlight squarely on MMA judging.
Ah, you know, people say controversial, and look, let's be honest about this. You know, here's the problem with what we have. In that fight, you look at Gil Melendez against Eddie Alvarez. The first round is pretty simple for anyone. They should be able to say Gil Melendez won that round. He hit Eddie with the bigger shots. He hurt Eddie. He hit Eddie with two right hands that really bothered Eddie as far as, you know, there's no doubt it broke his orbital. That's why his eye swelled up the way it did, especially when he decided to blow his nose during the break between rounds. But you look at the first round, there's no doubt who won that round. Now, if you get into the second round and even into the third round, this is now when you're getting into what is the judge giving credit to? What is he thinking is important in that round? Because I can sit here and you know, make a story for this is why Eddie Alvarez won, you know, the second round. This is why Eddie Alvarez won the third round. And I can sit there and make a story for it. This is why Gil Melendez won the second round, and this is why Gil Melendez won the third round. It's close, and it all depends upon what you're giving credit to. The real, you know, difference in the fight, if you're asking me, that you had damage done by Gil Melendez, and you had control done by Eddie Alvarez. And that's the real question of which is more important for the fight. Is it that you're going to give credit to damage, or are you going to give credit to control? Because Gil in, you know, the second round, I think, was looking for the big shot. He knew that he had Eddie in a position where Eddie was having a hard time seeing his right hand, and he's waiting to throw that big shot that's going to hurt Eddie. And he's also starting to feel that altitude of Mexico City at 7,000 feet. He's starting to get a little tired. Eddie has decided, you know what, I need to just get into him and I need to close that distance. I need to put my hands on him. I need to try to, you know, bring this into a different element where my eye is not going to be a factor. And so he started to fight a little bit different fight, and it was working for him. And Gil, in the second round, in my opinion, started to slow down his production. Now you get into the third round, you can look and say, Eddie is still trying to push with that wrestling aspect. People are going to say he got takedowns. He brought the fight into a different zone. But, you know, you should be looking is he doing anything that is damaging to Gil, or doing anything that is going to bring about an end to the fight? And that's where you're going to have a question about it. Gil was still landing some good shots on him. You know, it's not that they were really hurting Eddie, but it's a close fight. And to say it's controversial, you know, it's kind of like the Ben Henderson versus Gil Melendez fight. It was a close fight. And there are people that still to this day say Ben Henderson won that fight. And there's people that say Gil Melendez won that fight. And it's all depending upon what you're looking at and what you're giving credit to.
Well, I think a lot of the controversy comes from the punishment that Eddie Alvarez took, the way that his face looked. And we talk about this a lot here on the program. How do you assess damage? Because judges can get seduced by blood. Same for fans, same for media types. You see an eye swollen shut, or you see a big gash, but you can't repeatedly score that. It happens, there's the damage, and then you move on from the damage if you're judging the fight.
Yeah, you can only give it if the eye, you know, gets hit and it gets cut, great. Give credit to that. It's a good punch. It landed, it did damage to him. But I can't, you know, 2 minutes down the road, the cut is the same and there's never been any other shots, and I'm going to give credit to it again because, oh, he's bleeding more.
But some judges do.
Yeah,
you know that.
Some judges do that, but that's not what we're looking for. And, you know, you look in Eddie's face, if you're going to look at it, you know, he looked like he lost the fight. If you look at compared to Eddie and you put Eddie's picture up and Gil's picture up, everyone's going to say, who won that fight? Everyone's going to say Gil Melendez won the fight. But that's just, you know, that's one element that the judges are looking at. They're looking at that damage, but then they're looking at the output of what Eddie Alvarez did in that fight to control Gil, to make Gil have to fight a fight he didn't want to fight. And, you know, that's the one thing that really changed, in that they were both standing up cracking. And when the eye situation came in, Eddie changed, which is, I give him credit for. That shows that he's a multidimensional fighter. That shows that, you know what, he's a thinking man. And he changed, you know, what his game plan was and how he was going to go about, you know, trying to get Gil out of the fight. And it's what got him the win.
29-28 on all three judges' scorecards, obviously 2-1 in favor of Alvarez. I haven't seen it released, how the judges scored round by round. I'm assuming, though, that the fight swung on the second round.
It did swing on the second round. Most of the judges gave, all the judges I know gave Gil Melendez the first round.
They would have to.
I think there was two judges that gave Eddie Alvarez the second round, with one judge giving Gil Melendez. And then there was a switch in that in the third round.
Right.
So, yeah, it's close. And it's a close fight. And this is why, you know, when, you know, someone like Dana White says, don't leave it in the hands of the judges. Well, if you don't like, you know, the end result, if you're Gil Melendez and you say, I don't like the end result of that, don't leave it in the hands of the judges, you know. Gil knows that the biggest problem was, I'm not putting Eddie Alvarez down in any way for this. His biggest, you know, competition that night, although Eddie was the guy that was doing it, he got pushed to a limit where he got tired. And Gil never gets tired. And you could see that he got tired. He got really pushed past that comfort point. And that was the difference. It slowed his output down. It slowed what he does. You know, he's El Nino. He's the storm, you know, because he comes after people. And he really got tired. And it's really the first time that I've seen him get that tired in a fight.
John, our tagline on the program, we try to live up to it, is we separate fact from fiction. And a lot of fans, a lot of media types, certainly a lot of fighters have problems with split decisions. But there is a reason why in combat sports the judges don't just sit all together. It's not like blood sport where they just sit in one location. They are placed in different positions of the cage or of the ring. That is by design. That's historically by design to give them different views.
And it is about different views. And sometimes as a judge, you get to see the fight so perfectly and you get to see everything that tells you who won that round. And there are times when, you know what, it's not an easy thing to do because of the angles that you're getting. The fighters are cutting it off to where you don't see the punch land. You don't see how hard it hits the guy. You have a referee that sometimes is moving in front of you right when that punch is thrown, and you're like, God, I didn't see that. You're looking, but you're not going to see it the same as, you know, when someone is watching from all these different camera angles and they can pull the, you know, that good camera angle up. It's going to be different at times, but that's what makes judging what it is, and it's what makes it, it's hard, but it's also what makes it fair for the fighters, in that, you know what, they're not all seeing the same angles, and they can only go off of what they're seeing.
And what that means is that in a split decision, it doesn't necessarily mean that a judge is wrong.
No, it doesn't. You know, and it's you get all these people, what is he looking at? You know what? Why don't you go sit down there and get an idea what he's looking at? It's not what you think. And we have media guys all the time coming out and slamming judges and stuff. And then when they have to sit in that seat and they have to watch a fight in the same way, you know, we've done this with them, and they go, oh, my God, this is totally different. Because media people listen to the crowd. They listen to, you know, the internet. You know, they're on their thing and they're sitting there, and they may have an idea that, oh, I think that Gil Melendez won that fight. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's going on the internet and saying, and everyone's saying, oh, Gil got robbed. Yeah, he got robbed. And then they start writing, and it's like, that's not, you weren't watching that fight every second of that fight for three rounds the way the judge was. You need to watch it that way and then come up and right away tell me who won that round. Now you'll understand what it's like to be the judge, and, you know, it's not an easy job.
And I know this drives fighters crazy, and it's difficult for them to understand. And I'm not saying this is necessarily the case with Alvarez versus Melendez, but it's sort of the case. But hypothetically, fighter A versus fighter B. Fighter A has a dominant round one, wins it by a clear-cut 10-9. Fighter B wins a very close 10-9 round two, a very close 10-9 round three. Fighters are thinking, but I crushed him in round one.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You lost. It's not like Pride where you're scoring the entire fight.
It's
round
not.
By round, it's a wide 10-9, and then you lost a very close 10-9 and a very close 10-9.
Yeah, and it's, you know, as a judge, you are only judging that 5 minutes. Once that 5 minutes is over, once that bell rings and those fighters go back to the corner, everything you saw in the past is it's done. You know, you've given your score for that. Now it's on to the next, and that's a separate fight and unto itself, that second round. And then if it gets to the third, that's a separate fight unto itself for that round. And it does sometimes make it to where the judges can actually look. And even, you know, I'm telling you, the judges in Mexico City that night said, you know, if you look at it with the first round, I can understand how someone thinks that, you know, Gil Melendez won the fight. They go, but if you look at it round by round and what happened and what we what we're going with his score, I had to give it to Eddie Alvarez. And like I said, I can sit there and I can make that argument and I can understand why they're saying that.
As I was watching the fight on television, the thought occurred to me, just because you were refereeing this bout and I knew that it was going to be close. I wasn't sure who was going to win, but I knew it was going to be close, and I kind of felt the split decision coming. Up through the late 1970s, more often than not, in big boxing matches, the referee would be one of the judges.
Yeah.
I know Mills Lane talked about how difficult that was, that you have to do two jobs at once. That would put you in a really awkward position, because you have to look at a fight one way when you're refereeing. Now, can you imagine if you would had to have turned in a scorecard after 15 minutes of Alvarez versus Melendez?
Yeah, I can imagine it because I've done it, but I haven't done it in a big fight like Eddie versus Melendez.
Still at small levels,
yeah.
I guess you do
yeah,
it from time
you know,
to time.
There's been times when, you know, things have happened and we don't have a judge, and so the referee will actually judge. I've done it. It is different because as the referee, you're not caring who's winning the fight as far as technique-wise or anything like that. You're worried about damage. And so, you know, I can tell you that if, you know, if you could have had a camera on me and seeing what my eyes, I was looking at Eddie Alvarez for a vast majority of that fight. My attention is on Eddie because Eddie is my fighter that's damaged. He's got an eye problem. I want to make sure that that eye is working. I want to see that he's actually being able to see the right hands that are being thrown. So I'm spending a lot of time looking at Eddie Alvarez during that fight because I don't have to worry about what Gil's doing. But if I'm judging that fight now, I'm going to have to take away some of that emphasis on watching the guy just for safety, and I've got to actually watch the fight now to say who's winning on a scorecard. It makes me do my job in a different fashion. It's not fair to the referee. It's not fair to the fighters. It's always good to have a separate person that's outside just doing that one job. When, you know, no matter what anyone says, you're going to be better off doing one job than trying to do two jobs at the same time.
I know as a commentator, so often after split decision fights or even unanimous decision fights, the winning fighter, the losing fighter after the show will ask me my opinion, and I'll say, honestly, I'm not sure, because as a commentator, I'm looking at a lot of different things than I would be as a judge. And
yeah.
Jimmy Smith, full credit, his scorecards are spot on, and that's not easy because Jimmy has to call the fight with me. He's got to look at a lot of things. Our producer's talking in our ear. We have to take cues and counts, and we have to throw to things. But Jimmy's also trying to assess, and he's also trying to turn in a
Jimmy
scorecard.
Does, you know, Jimmy does, and you know, I tell him all the time, for a guy who's having to talk during the entire fight, now he's watching the fight, but he's talking, and so that takes some of that concentration, and it, you know, puts it on the other side where it makes it to where he can miss things. And Jimmy does. I tell him, I said, dude, 98% of the time you're spot on. You know, you get it. And there's every now and then I'll go, no, he missed that one, and it's understandable. He's talking during the fight, but I mean, he is fantastic. He would be a fantastic MMA judge, but he does a fantastic job of actually knowing who won that round compared to who shouldn't have gotten the round.
John, where would we be without judging controversies, though? Really, where would this sport be? What would they have to write about on the internet?
You know, you're always going to have controversies in fighting just because, you know, look, at when people are watching it, they want one person to win. And so whatever that person's doing is better than maybe what it really is. And whatever their opponent is doing is not quite as good as it might be. And, you know, that's part of, if you have somebody that you want to win in the fight, you can't judge it fairly. It just doesn't work. You've got to go in there. You don't care who wins. You care that the right person gets your score based upon the production that they do in that round.
And I'll tell you as a commentator, because I know that commentators can and do influence the way that people see fights, I absolutely do not care who wins. I am completely neutral. I have very close friendships with some fighters. I don't dislike any fighters, and I say that honestly. I'm just not the type of person who really dislikes people. Obviously, I have my friends, but I don't care.
That's it.
Just want an entertaining fight, because if I do care even a little bit, it's going to come through consciously or subconsciously, and then I'm going to start influencing opinion. I think that's the death of a commentator. If you start to show any type of favoritism at all, any type of bias, I think you're done.
Yeah, many times in the back, you know, I tell fighters when I'm talking to them, look, I don't care who wins and loses here. And I'm being honest, I don't. I have cared one time in my life. One fight. It was Matt Lindland against Murillo Bustamante, and I didn't care going in. But when I made a mistake and made Murillo have to continue on after he tapped and I screwed it up, I wanted Murillo Bustamante to win that fight. But other than that, I've never cared. And I tell him, you know, look, I don't care who wins this fight. I care about you as a person. I care about your safety. And, you know, if you start to have a prejudice, because that's really what it is, towards one from one fighter to the other, it can alter your, you know, perception. It can alter your the way you do things. It can alter you being fair. And my job is to be fair to the fighters. Your job is to be fair to what is actually happening and to relay that to the viewers.
Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri. Big John will answer your question submitted via email at letsgetitonpodcast.com. And we'll speak with Bellator president Scott Coker in an exclusive interview.
The big man.
With John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock, and you are listening to Let's Get It On.
When looking for new and exciting clothing concepts, look no further than Lambs to Lions. Lambs to Lions has great designs that incorporates the past from boxing with the new and exciting evolution of MMA. We all start out as lambs, but with time, training, and hard work, we can all become lions. Be part of the Lambs to Lions movement and check out all of their great designs. You can get your Lambs to Lions gear at the Las Vegas Fight Shop or go to lambstolionsbrand.com.
It's the book that Wrestling Observer calls a must-read for any MMA fan. Jonathan Snowden of Bleacher Report describes as riveting and amazing, and thefightnerd.com says nothing is held back. Pick this book up right away. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it, written by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by John McCarthy, is now available to listeners of this podcast at the special price of $12.48. That's far less than you'll pay for the book on Amazon and half price of what you'll pay in store at Barnes & Noble. Buy it directly from the publisher now online at ascendbooks.com and enter the promo code LEGAL50. That's ASCENDbooks.com, promo code LEGAL50. Learn the true story of how the UFC came into existence in the book that Randy Couture describes as honest, shocking, and enthralling, and that has a rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars from Amazon Reader Reviews. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by Big John McCarthy. Available now online at ascendbooks.com for just $12.48 when you use the promo code LEGAL50.
Back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Sean Wheelock and Big John McCarthy.
Every week on this podcast, Big John and I answer your questions. Fire away via email. Ask whatever you'd like. Info at letsgetitonpodcast.com. And of course, please include a pronunciation guide for your name. First up, Frank Garrick, who did include a pronunciation guide for his name, but he's a great MMA referee. You trained him, John. I knew it anyway, Frank, but thanks for the help nonetheless on how to say your last name. So Frank asks, at last Saturday's UFC in Mexico City, Nate Marquardt's corner tried to stop the fight in the second round and was told by the UFC that he had to get off of the apron because he was obstructing people's view. He was told that only the ref or doctor can stop the fight. As this was in Mexico and there was no presiding commission, it's the UFC's responsibility to ensure that the fighters are being protected. Frank continues, his corner has to be allowed to throw the towel or communicate to the inspector that the match needs to be stopped. John, how does a breakdown of that magnitude occur?
All right, well, let's clear up some stuff here first. First off, it's not the UFC that is telling them to sit down and, you know, you don't block people's views. There is a commission as far as Mexico. They're learning. And when it comes to any commission, they're all learning, and it's all an evolution. What the UFC does is they're bringing in inspectors from the state of Nevada. People that are inspectors working in the state of Nevada come to Mexico City, and they're working with the inspectors and people that are part of the new commission in Mexico City. Now, Trevor Whitman is the trainer for Marquardt. And I'm going to put a little bit this on both sides, because, you know, when we come in the back and we're going to talk to the fighters about protocols, about bout conduct, about the rules, you know, we always bring in making sure that the second, their second assist, their chief second, is with them while we give that instruction. Because if they have a question, we want to be able to answer. We want them knowing exactly what is going on too. And so when we sit there and we say, all right, I'm going to ask you right now, do you have any questions about what the unified rules are? Is there anything that you don't understand? Is there anything you need me to clarify? Is there anything that you say, well, I'd like to do it this way. Is this going to be okay? Ask me now. Let me know. And when they go, nope, we're good. That's saying what? That's saying you know what the unified rules are. So if you know what the unified rules are, then you know that you can throw a frickin' towel to stop the fight. Back in 2001, when we first put them together, yes, that was something that Mark Ratner, being the executive director of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, wanted put in as a foul. That's why it was number 31. It was the last thing. It was the only thing that he really brought in that he wanted. That in the state of Nevada, they do not like the throwing of the towel. And so when you have an inspector who's from the state of Nevada, he's going to go off of what is normal for him. But as the chief second, Trevor Whitman is a good trainer. And he should know that, yes, he can throw that towel. He doesn't have to get down. If he wants the fight stopped, jump into the octagon. All right? That's your job. You know your fighter better than anybody. And I know that Trevor does know Nate. And I agree with him that fight, you know, he was in trouble. And I have no problem with him wanting to stop the fight. So then stop the fight. Get up. Throw the towel. Get your butt up in the ring. I don't care. Take care of your fighter. So when you sit there and you say it's an error against the UFC, no, this is an error where we have the difference in rules between the unified rules and a state in Nevada that comes and says, you know what, we're going to alter that. This is why I'm always saying everybody should just follow the unified rules. Quit putting your own stuff and adding on to saying, well, oh, we're better or we're safer because we don't allow a linear kick or we don't allow this type of elbow or we don't do this. All you're doing is putting confusion in there. And when you have the inspector who all he ever works with is, no, you cannot throw the towel, well, that's what he's going to kind of do when the pressure's on. He's going to say, no, you can't do that, even though, yes, Trevor Whitman could have.
The unified rules, no one wants to hear this, but it's true. They're guidelines. In my home state of Kansas, you throw in the towel, guess what? Automatic disqualification.
That's what they want. Who cares?
Mississippi, they allow 12 to 6 elbows.
Yes.
The unified rules
Tennessee,
are just guidelines.
Tennessee, no linear knee kicks. I mean, everyone's got their own little thing. They say, oh, yeah, this makes us better. It doesn't make you better. It makes you different, which in the end only makes you a problem.
Our next question comes from Steve Ward. This is a follow-up to his question last week that we read here on the program. So Steve asks, John, as a retired police officer, I took my ABC referee class in 2012. I've worked a bunch of amateur shows, and I want to get into some bigger ones. What should I do next? Now, the problem is that I live in New York, so I have to travel to other states to referee. Should I start applying in different states to become a professional licensed referee?
Well, it all comes down to you. I don't know what your true background is, and so it's hard for me to answer, but let me try to go through this as quick as I can for you. You took an ABC certified course. That's great. Okay, that is, you know, one of maybe 6 or 7 instructors that are out there. It could be a Kevin McDonald, a Rob Hines.
I think he took the Rob Hines course.
Okay, well, if you took Rob Hines course, at least you're taking a good course. And the one thing that I will tell you is that basically like shaves off a little bit of the lemon zest off of the skin for you, because now you've been introduced to something and you've taken this and have an idea about the rules and stuff. All of those amateur fights are what you're looking for to make you better. Those are what are going to give you the experience in making mistakes, because you're going to make mistakes, and to how to figure out, how did I make that mistake? How do I make it so I don't do that again? And how do I just continue to evolve so I understand how to handle all these different problems? If you've gone through, we'll say, 2 to 4 years of amateurs, I'm telling you, okay, you've probably done enough, depending upon where you're at, in amateur fights to where if you want to start to apply for a pro license, you can go to a state athletic commission, show them your resume, and the one thing I will tell you is don't frickin' lie about what you've done. Don't sit here and tell me you've done 1,000 fights when you've done 73, okay? Guys do it all the time. They're always trying to bump things up. It's a matter of you need to be honest about what you do. You need to be honest about what experience you have. Go to that athletic commission and say, here's my experience. I would like to start working for you. Now, if the athletic commission starts to come back to you and say, well, we don't have any positions as a referee right now, you can reapply later. Then say, well, I would just like to get in the door with you. Can I be an inspector? Can I work with you in any fashion? I just want to be part of the sport. I get a lot of guys that'll sit there and go, I'm not an inspector, I'm a referee. Well, no, let's just break this down. You're what I call an idiot, okay? Because you don't have the aptitude to understand. You need to do things to show people who you are, what you are, how you work, what kind of, you know, morals you have. And the way to do that is to get your foot in the door. And if that's to be an inspector, then be an inspector. And if that's you're going to be an inspector for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 7 years, so what? Start getting your foot in the door. Don't be so stubborn as a lot of people are that I am a referee. No, look, if that's your attitude, you're right there telling the commission they don't want to work with you. So whatever you need to do to start getting in with those athletic commissions, be open. Be available. Be someone that is there as something that is going to be add value to the commission instead of someone that is just trying to just wanting one role. That one role is great, but the more you know about all the roles, the better off you're going to be.
Remember, keep your excellent questions coming via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Well, Big John and I are with you this week from St. Louis, Missouri. We're on site for Bellator Unfinished Business, Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock, one of the biggest cards in Bellator history, which John will be refereeing and I'll be commentating with Jimmy Smith. Earlier here in St. Louis, John and I spoke exclusively with Bellator president Scott Coker, and I began by asking him about the challenges of taking over the promotion last June from Bjorn Rebney.
You know, there's been a lot of challenges we've had in the last year, but I think the biggest one is really the unknown. You know, there's been a lot of landmines that in the very beginning of the company kept popping up, and, you know, we would fix them and move on, but I think we're finally through that phase now. But, you know, it was not knowing, you know, where they all were. So at the end of the day, you know, it's been a year since I took over the company, and the vision really was you know, like, not so much about who the staff was going to be, where we'd be located, but really it was more about, okay, this is the end goal that, you know, that I want to create. And when I sat down with Kevin Kay, I really liked what he had to say. He really got it. And he understands MMA. He's still a fan. He still watches all the fights. And, you know, he wants to go to the top. And that's really where I want this company to go. You know, we want to have the best fighters. We want to have the best production. We want to build these characters, these fighters into characters that are, you know, bigger than life, so to speak. I mean, a lot of our fights that we're putting on today is really a playbook right out of the Japanese MMA fight business, and casting a little bit bigger net, not just a hardcore fan, but a fan that, you know, hey, somebody called me today and said, hey, you know, the people at the office are talking about it. And it's not just the guys, it's the girls, the Kimbo Slice Ken Shamrock fight. And so we've cast a little bit bigger net than maybe just a hardcore audience. And then we'll have some fights for the really hardcore fans. And that's really, really right out of Japan, because they would put on a fight that their general population would like to see, and then they would put on a lot of hardcore fights underneath. And I think that's a great formula.
You know, being the guy who created Strikeforce, and you've got to take pride in the fact that your Strikeforce fighters have proved themselves to be incredibly talented, and have, you know, the victories keep piling up. And you've gotten your first champion that was Strikeforce champion, and Daniel Cormier being the Grand Prix heavyweight champion. He won the light heavyweight. And now you got Luke Rockhold, who's going to be fighting Weidman. How much pride do you take in that?
I mean, honestly, I feel like the dad, you know? Like, I'm over there with my baseball clicker, win. Okay, maybe loss, win, loss. So, you know, to me, it's part of something that I feel like it helped create. And here's the thing I think is really important, because at that time, in fact, I had a reporter ask me this the other day, and he said, well, you know, Strikeforce was so much fun. You guys had all these great fights, and they were fun, you know, and you weren't worried about having the best fighters in the world. And I said, whoa, time out. You know, are you talking about Daniel Cormier? Are you talking about Luke Rockhold? Are you talking about Ronda Rousey that started in Strikeforce? Are you talking about Gina Carano that built her career in Strikeforce? Are you talking about Tyron Woodley? Or are you talking about, you know, Josh Thompson, Kung Lee? I mean, who exactly are you talking about? Because these are the fighters that are, you know, kicking ass in the UFC right now. So the same thing that's happening here in Bellator, you know, it's like some of the fighters I don't think are getting the respect they deserve, but they will shine at the end because we're going to put them in great fights. We're going to build them on Spike TV, and they're going to be the futures of the stars for Bellator. But I think it's the perception, you know, that, oh, you know what, you have to go to a certain league to have that respect. But I'm telling you right now, the stars that were over there, that were in Strikeforce, that eventually migrated to the UFC because of the sale, we have that talent base here now. The base of talent in this company is impressive, and they're going to be the future stars of MMA.
Scott, what I liked as a hardcore fan of our sport about Strikeforce is that all of your shows felt big. And I had a chance with Jimmy Smith. We did the world feed on your Strikeforce in Chicago in 2008, Fedor Emelianenko versus Brett Rogers. As a commentator, that felt big. Coming into this St. Louis show, since you've taken over Bellator, our shows now are starting to, in Bellator, feel big. And I guess it's part of you as a promoter. It's the presentation. It's just how you put forth MMA to the public.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about my first MMA show, we had 18,000 people there. It was the first show in California. But, you know, we were very good live event promoters. The first year we had shows. We had Frank Shamrock, we had Kung Lee, we had Melendez, Thompson, fighting on the first card, sold out. I get it, first show in California. Second show, a lot of people don't remember this show, but it was a main event that Pride sent over, because I was working for K1 at the time. I asked them to help us out, and it was Alistair Overeem fighting Vitor Belfort, right? So 14,000 people, $900,000 gross gate. We had no TV deal. We had no sponsorships for the whole first year. None of those fights ever got seen. We made DVDs because we filmed it all in HD, luckily, and we recorded it for archival purposes. But those shows for the first year all had attendances of, you know, let's say 13,000 plus. So as far as being good live event promoters, I think that's something we're very good at.
You've always been known as the promoter that will work with other promoters, which is something that's not done with other leagues and other promotions that are there. Are you looking to start to partner up Bellator with other outside promotions at times to put on fights that people want to see?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it makes sense, scheduling, timing, I mean, we're going to do a lot more fights next year than we're doing this year. So we're going to be very busy. But, you know, if there was an emerging league or somebody that we've worked with in the past that has a fighter they want to borrow and it made sense and the timing, let's do it, man. Win, lose, or draw. I mean, that's part of the Bushido spirit, right, is the competition. And if they have to go to Japan or they have to go to Europe and we have a good fighter sharing experience with the promoter and it's a good win-win for everybody, we'll do it. Yeah, we would love to do it.
The main event for this show that we're all here for in St. Louis, Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock. I can feel pretty confident in saying it. I've been with Bellator now 6 years, since Bellator 13. Under the previous regime, this fight probably doesn't happen. And yet, this is likely our biggest show to date. TV ratings, I'm speculating now, I think, knock on wood, are going to be very big. We're all touching wood here. Do you see a sea change, though, with the way fans now are perceiving Bellator, because it's not locked into the rigid tournament system, the fact that you can make fun fights that people want to see, that everything has to be so incredibly serious?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, why would you not want to put on fights that would draw huge ratings?
Yeah, fully agreed.
You know, honestly, I don't understand that philosophy at all. But, you know, that is what it is. My philosophy goes like this. Bonner, Ortiz, 2.2 million for that whole fight. So that fight, you know, had a 2.2 million average. And this fight might be able to beat that. So let's say it goes to 3 million or 2.5, or let's say it goes to 2 million or whatever it is. The beauty of that is the fighters are all fighting underneath. the fans are going to be able to see it all, right? They're going to see our young super studs that are coming up, or Pitbull fighting, you know, Weichel. I mean, you know, they're going to see that, and then I feel they'll become fans of those guys as well. So generate the eyeballs with how you do, you know, how you have to do it, but we'll build stars underneath with those eyeballs on our broadcast.
You know, when you're talking about putting eyeballs on new fighters, who are the new fighters or fighters within Bellator right now that you are looking at as your guys of the future?
Well, there's a lot, actually, and it's, you know, there's a couple that come into my mind right now that are some of the new guys that I feel like could be something special. One is a kid named Henry Corrales who's fighting, you know. Yeah, and so he came highly recommended. We watched some film on him. I said, wow, this guy is a fighter. And those are the kind of fights that I like, you know, guys that bring it.
And never gets his hair messed up.
There you go. But you know what? That's, you know, that's a kid that has an undefeated record. And when we said, hey, you want to, you know, come fight on this card against a – I mean, come on. He's fighting a guy that is no joke, that almost won the title, got submitted at the very end. But he might have been winning that fight, you know, up to that point. And so – he said, "You know what? Let's do it. I want to test myself. Let's go." And I like that. But there's actually too many guys to really mention. But Henry Corrales is definitely one of them. You know, we signed Ed Ruth and Pico, but they're developmental projects that probably will be a year and a half in the making. But the reason why we signed those guys, especially because Pico, he came to us already having a boxing experience, wanting to fight in combat sports when he's done. I mean, it's very clear. He said to me, I want to be the greatest combat sports fighter in the planet of all time, not just today, of all time. I want to be the – I have an Olympic gold medal. I want to have a MMA world championship belt. I might want to try kickboxing, and I might want to do boxing. You know, like I want to be the greatest of all, you know. I said, "Oh, you want to be, you know, the next Bruce Lee, is it?" But, you know, so he's somebody that I knew. And then Ed Ruth just came highly recommended, and we followed his career. I went to watch him wrestle, and, you know, he says that he really wants to do this. So we all know that when they have that wrestling background, the transition sometimes is very successful. You look at all the great wrestlers that have been successful in MMA. I mean, it's one of the main disciplines.
Scott, John and I talk about this on the program all the time, of just how young our sport of MMA is. It's not even 22 years old. You know, you think about the NFL going back to 1920. If you're talking about what happened in Major League Baseball from the early 90s, it's not that long ago. But in MMA, even 8 years ago, is a very long time. What do you see as the continual evolution of our sport? Because it is so young, it's still gaining so many fans, so many people are still trying to kind of come to the sport that maybe haven't yet.
I mean, it's going to evolve, and the fighting in the cage has evolved. And I think that, you know, at first it was the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu dominating everything, and then the wrestlers came in and started, you know, fighting their style of ground and pound and just, you know, being able to take the guys down. And then I think Maurice Smith came in and said, "Oh, you know what? I'm going to knock you out with a head kick." Then they're like, "Oh, we got to do Thai boxing now." And so now it's going to become like a very well-rounded fighting system, right? So I think as that has evolved, I think that the fan base has accepted now MMA, because when you're talking about, let's say, 2006, that's, you know, 9 years ago, MMA was still taboo. I remember we did the first fight in San Jose, and the CBS reporter comes up to me and goes, "Well, is this like a, you know, is this like chicken fighting in the cage? Is somebody gonna get killed tonight?" And I'm like, "You know, you have no idea of really what this is. You know, this is a martial arts contest. You know, it's in a cage, but it's a contest. This is a martial arts competition. You know, and the moves of jiu-jitsu and boxing and Thai boxing, you know, or taekwondo, whatever, those are allowed in the Olympics." Right? I mean, you can choke in the Olympics, you can armbar in the Olympics, but you put them in a cage and you throw a choke and armbar, they're like, "Oh, this is terrible," you know. He's, you know, but they just don't know. And it's the uneducated that have become educated now, right? So no mainstream television back then. Think about it, only pay-per-view. but no CBS, no Fox, no Showtime, no HBO. I mean, nothing, right? So think about, but 10 years later, every network has something now, it seems like, of MMA, and or has, you know, been into, like, Showtime came in, and you know, Fox has their thing, you know, Viacom, Spike have our thing. But it just seems like it's more accepted now. And I think that's going to continue to grow. And it's just going to become part of the culture, you know, of the future. And I think that, you know, when you look at the first fan in 93, that fan's in his 40s now, right? Maybe even 50s. So it's grown, and it's proven the test of time to me. So it's not going away. Because honestly, in 2006, when we did the first fight, we set up for 7,000 people at the HP Pavilion. And I remember sitting down with Frank Shamrock going, Frank, how many tickets do you think we'll be able to sell? He says, maybe 7,000-8,000, you know. I said, okay, we'll set up for 7,000-8,000. And we didn't know what to expect. And I remember going, well, you know what? This could be like a one-time thing. Maybe the commission shuts it down. Maybe it's like a fad. People didn't know. They just didn't know. And that was only 9 years ago. So we have a lot of years of growth ahead of in the sport. And somebody asked me, well, you and the UFC. And I go, look, it's not us against the UFC. We are both in a martial arts industry trying to grow the industry. And the industry is more important than any league, right? And one, to me, you need to have two to keep it healthy and to grow it and have fighters have a choice. And, you know, it's just going to be better. But compare MMA to NFL football, right? Or baseball. You think any MMA league, can be in 28 or 34 cities across the country, sell out stadiums every Sunday, or, you know, San Jose Sharks, where I live, sell out 16,000 seats three times a week, Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturday? No, it's not happening. So I'm just telling you, this is something we all have to grow together. And if not, it's going to become, you know, I think it's just going to become like a niche sport, and it's kind of fragmented sport. But I think it's all headed in a positive direction, because with Spike TV behind it, with different networks behind it, internationally, it's becoming accepted. There's a few countries that won't do it still, but for the most part, we've seen distributing around the world that, you know, 98% of the countries will do it. And, you know, we see the growth in the future. And it's not just here in America, but it's internationally too.
Let's make one thing clear with that. That 8,000 seats that he said he was hoping to sell, that show sold over 18,000. Yeah. So that's a pretty good promotional win. But the one thing I want to know is, you know, Scott, you have been in this sport for a long time. Mm-hmm. And you've seen a lot, and you've worked with a lot of different people. What is the one thing that if you had the ability to change one thing within the world of MMA, the sport, rules, whatever, what is it that you would change to think to make it better?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, I feel like we're doing our part and trying to contribute to the growth of the sport. You know, if there was one thing, I'd have to chew on that one. That's a great question. Let me get back to you on the next podcast.
Yeah, you're not supposed to stump our guest, John.
You know, what's so true is when you have people that have been part of the sport for a long time, there's so many things that you would look at. You go, I'd like to change this. I'd like to change that. And it's hard to come up with just that one, because they're all kind of important to you, and there's so many different things that you can look at that you can say, I think this would really benefit the sport. I think this would make it better. And, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, what rule would you change?
Well, 12 to 6 elbows.
Oh, God, yeah, get rid of that thing. It's pathetic. It's horrible. It's ridiculous. But, I mean, there's so many things that, you know, that have evolved in the sport, so many things that have changed, and there's still more to come. And it's important that everyone is always working to always help with that evolution and make things better for the fighters, for the promoters, for everyone.
Yeah, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. I mean, there's so many moving parts to keeping this business going and healthy and profitable that it's hard to just think of one. And because when you think of the promotion side, you also have to think about the fighter side. Otherwise, it doesn't work, because they're your partner in this whole process. And there's the network side, then there's the sponsor side, there's the international distribution side. I mean, there's a lot of pieces. A lot of people don't, you know, probably understand this business the way that we do, but there's a lot of moving parts, and it's it gets complicated.
You know, the fighters listening to this podcast are rejoicing when you're actually saying, as the president of a major MMA company, there's a fighter side, because sometimes they're kind of left out of the equation.
I mean, I don't see how that's even possible. You know, we've always.
But you know, it's true. Not from you in Strikeforce or Bellator, yeah. But you know, industry wide, big and small, that is the case.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that is it's a short term thinking, because at the end of the day, you know, they're your partners, you know, and whether it's one fight or two fights or three fights, you know, they're your partners for that time that you guys are together. So, I've always chosen to have a really good relationship with our athletes. As much as I can, and it's worked out. I think that that's why a lot of fighters have stayed, or you know, that fighters have had a good time working at Strikeforce, or you know, working here at Bellator with us.
Does it? You've always had that reputation of being the promoter that fighters like, that fighters are happy with, and they want to be around and stuff. Is it? I know that the Quentin Jackson situation really has nothing to do with you, but has that caused you any kind of, you know, problem, or do you feel like in some way that if you had gotten a hold of it earlier, it wouldn't have happened, and you wouldn't have had that employee that basically had discontent over things that happened?
Yeah, I mean, that was a unique situation, you know, and I don't want to comment on, you know, legal stuff, but I will say this, that, you know, my past history shows that we've had good relationship with most of our athletes. And, you know, I do believe if it was under a different circumstance, we probably would have a great relationship and you know, be able to have some kind of resolution and move forward, you know. But it's just unfortunate that it's come down to this, you know.
I ask this with a lot of self-interest. Where do you see Bellator progressing? Because I want to know. John, you want to know too, actually. We're very selfish in these questions, Scott. But just the progression of Bellator. And I like what you said a moment ago, that there needs to be competition. And John and I, we talk about this all the time on this show, is it's not just us against them, one promotion over another. We're an industry. We're an MMA industry. We're fans of everything. We watch everything. But of the progression, Scott, of Bellator, as you see moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I've been here 1 year. And I think we've accomplished some great things. And to me, I want to keep our tent poles growing, do more tent poles, and I want to start building our fighters into, like, characters. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, as a fighter comes down the ramp, you have the pre-roll, the B-roll, and all the – but that's what I loved about Pride, was before they even walked out, the music starts, I already know who's coming out, right? Josh Barnett, the whole Superman video B-roll they create for him. Oh, Josh Barnett's coming out, right? And so right away, and it was, to me, it was just like a no-brainer. Like when I said, okay, I'm going to come back into it, you know, I want to build something big. I want to build something that is going to be entertaining, that that not just the hardcore fans will resonate towards, but, you know, all the fringe fans. Like, it's just a night of entertainment, right? And so I sat down with Kevin. I said, I really want to build this thing out, and, you know, and we need the big screens, and we're going to need the pyro. This has to be an entertainment product, you know, not just a fight product. And we can do both, but I want to bring the entertainment back to MMA. And I think that's really important, because that's a differentiator for us, right? And more tent poles, bigger fights, bigger names. We'll build some of the guys. We'll buy some of the guys when they're free agents. And that's kind of how I did it with Strikeforce, was – we proved we can build fighters from the ground up, which we're going to do here, which we are doing here already. And then we'll buy the free agents and, you know, hit them from the top down when they're free. And that's how we'll round up this roster, you know. So we'll have a robust roster. But I really believe that when somebody comes to our show and pays, you know, $50, $7,500, whatever the money is, I want them to leave and say, you know what, that was worth way more than I paid for it.
I'm going to put you on the spot here with a question. If given the opportunity to put together a fight that was just a fun fight, that had characters, that had people that other people wanted to see, that were they had interest in, or the number one versus the number two, Which fight do you want to be that?
I'm telling you right now, the main event would be the fans to the fans, man. bring me the 5 million eyeballs, because this is the way I equate it to. You might be the best fighter in the world, right? But that doesn't mean people want to see you, right? So we might have to keep building you for a while. But you know what? Bring me the fight the fans want to see. That is the water cooler talk on the Friday afternoon or the Saturday afternoon of the fight, and the fight that will pack the venue, right? Because there are world champions out there in different leagues that are great fighters, but they're missing some of the X factor, right? The media training or whatever, or sometimes either you have it or you don't, right? To get over, I'm talking about not the hardcore fans, but I'm talking about the general population. You know, sometimes the fighter doesn't cross over, right? So that's really what we're looking for, is who's the fighter that crosses over. And that's the guy that we want to put, you know, on TV to generate the eyeballs. Because on the undercard, you could build the new guys and you could build the guys. But, you know, how many great actors are in L.A., right? Does that mean you're a box office draw? No, it means you're a great actor, right? And you'll have your platform to act, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be a superstar in the film business.
Scott, final question. Sitting here with us watching is our mutual good friend, Jerry Millen, who hired me at Pride. All of us, we've talked about...
possibly Jerry's biggest mistake ever.
We've all been talking about Pride, all big fans. It was really a thrill for me being the final English language commentator at Pride. And Pride had all the legitimate top fighters in the world, many of the best fighters in the world. But they also had room for Zulazinho and Eric Butterbean Ash and Giant Silva. It's like they understood that you can be serious and you can be fun. Isn't that sort of the philosophy that you're instilling at Bellator? You can be serious, you can have great fighters, but you can also have a lot of fun and engage people.
Yeah, I think we just said this earlier, but it's right out of the Japanese playbook. You know, I mean, to me, I think they did it right. They cast a bigger net, create more of the mainstream audience to come tune in. But on the undercard or part of the fight card, you would have some real serious fights. But why not have some fun fights once in a while that people want to see? I mean, I remember going to a fight and who was fighting? I can't remember. It might have been Aki Bono versus Hoyce Gracie.
Yeah, K-1.
Okay, so yeah.
Another referee in that fight.
that was you. So you're like, okay, this is crazy, right? Aki Bono's just going to fall on Hoyce and then he's going to flatten him, right? But people were like, this is a crazy fight, right? This is nuts. But on the undercard, they had some, you know, you had the K-1 fighters were the real deal. And they would go out, and Ernesto Hoos was fantastic, Remy Bonjeski, Peter Arts. These guys were the best fighters in the world in kickboxing. But why not go to an event where you can see it all? And that's what they provided. They provided an event that you could see A through Z.
That's Bellator MMA President Scott Coker, who spoke with John and me earlier here in St. Louis, Missouri, as we're on site for Bellator Unfinished Business, Kimbo Slice versus Ken Shamrock. We're back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @podcastmma for this show, and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, that is info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. For John McCarthy, Scott Coker, our producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock, only on the Ignotainment Media Network. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the Eight Ball, The Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk at ignotainment.com.